Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. How has the tank revolutionised warfare in the century since it was first deployed in 1916? And how has military strategy adapted to take account of opponents' real or perceived tank strengths and tactics? And with the increased deployment of rockets and drones, is the age of the main battle tank now passing in favour of lighter, more nimble armour? In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Tank Warfare, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about the century of the tank.
Professor Jeremy Black, when the tank was in its early stages of development, did its developers see it as a development from a cavalry lancer with an internal combustion engine, or did they think of it as like a medieval siege engine with an internal combustion engine?
Well, I think what one needs to emphasise about the tank is that although the idea of the application of a locomotive steam engine to a road vehicle, or as it were, a non-rail vehicle, was not new, the tank itself is developed in World War One in response to very specific problems, and in particular, the very specific problems of trench warfare. And I think one needs to make that as a more general point. Whenever we have a discussion like this, Graham, I always think it's useful to try and bring out the broader points. That although military history, military affairs are sometimes studied or presented in terms of blue sky ideas, as if somebody is sort of investing in some technological optimum, which may sometimes happen, in general, in practical terms, the investment and the interest relate to very specific problems, and that is what tends to lead to government support. So one can see that with jet aircraft in the 1940s, as opposed to the much less interest in jet technology in the 1930s. Ideas, in other words, that you might see as leading towards the tank were there prior to World War One, but I think it's very much the specific issues of the trenches. And on the British side, I would also emphasize the very interest in technological development of the Navy, and in particular of the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. And you can see this also in the role of the Navy, as I've mentioned in my book on air warfare, the role of the Navy in its interest in bombing Germany. And the Navy plays a major role in the development of Germany, and in fact Antwerp as well, once the Germans have taken it in the early stages. And in a sense, this is part of what one would see more generally with Churchill in the early stages of the war. You can also see it with his ideas for trying to take Turkey out of the war with the Gallipoli enterprise. These are the attempts to circumvent what appears to be the impasse on the trenches, or at least to tackle that in a more innovative fashion. And I would locate the tank there, though it's important to mention that there is an important separate French genesis of the tank. So the two main powers that in the 19-teens developed tank technology are Britain and France. I mean, it's ironic that, you know, so often people are obsessed with the supposed quality of the Germans. In fact, the Germans in World War One singularly fail to show a comparable initiative and comparable implementation. And most of the German tanks, now, it's possibly going a little far, many of the German tanks, there are very few of them in 1918, are in fact captured Allied ones that have been repurposed.
Well, I want to come to the Germans in a moment, but if you can just circle back on this question of who invented the First World War version of the tank. We'll leave aside Leonardo da Vinci and various theoretical earlier prospects. The French and the British developed tanks at roughly the same time. Were they in collaboration or was it entirely independent? And also, what do you make of the claims by the Russians that they actually invented the tank?
I'm not impressed by the latter. I briefly mentioned them in the book I've written. Russia experimented with tank designs, the so-called Tsar design of 1914-15, which was really using a sort of tricycle design rather than caterpillar tracks. And I think it's fair to say it was insufficiently powered, as the tests showed in 1915, for the three guns that it tried to carry. And in fact, its development was abandoned in December 15. They start on another design in October 1916. No progress is made, and it's not battle usable. So I'm afraid I don't find the Russian claim viable. As far as the British and the French are concerned, I think what one needs to bear in mind is that the tank is the bringing together of a number of technologies, let alone the ability to manufacture them and then to use them. So you've got to have treads, you've got to have multiple wheel and multiple axle assemblies, you've got to have a sort of armored carapace, sort of rather like the exoskeleton of an insect, and you've got to have you don't have to have, because you could have the gun completely stationary, but most tanks you also want some form of a sponson, which is an outside gun unit which has a traverse, in other words, which is movable. So some of those were carryovers from steam tractors, the treads and the multiple wheel and axle assemblies. And I mentioned 19th century steam-powered road vehicles. But if you're looking at the armor, if you're looking at the sponsons, if you're looking at the turrets, these are innovations which are really from warships. And that's one of the reasons why I would say the Navy is, and naval ideas are so very important. And it's worth bearing in mind, again, I've already mentioned the point, but this is an age of innovation in naval warfare, which you also see, obviously, with the submarine, with motor torpedo boats, with a whole host of things. And the tank, in some respects, is an aspect of some of that technology and some of that aspiration. So, the interesting thing is in World War One, and you see this with the pressure on the British in 1916 to deploy their tanks. You've got a new technology being developed with very little understanding. I don't mean that to be critical, but obviously understanding rests, in terms of, you often find out what's going to work by seeing what doesn't work and where it goes wrong. Think vaccines, for example, which are marvelous things, but obviously they do require a process of testing, which is what's going on at the moment. So with weapons systems, the difficulty is, if you're having to use your weapons system pretty well at once, which is, I think it's fair to say, what happened with the tank. The Hague, the first British tanks are built in January 16, and these are very much initial design, but Haig wants to employ them swiftly, which is to his credit. Everybody always goes for Haig. Haig, of course, wants to employ them swiftly because he wants to see if they can be used to cut the casualties suffered by his troops. So it's fully understandable. It's no such thing as, it's only idiots who argue that there is a obvious best. So Haig wants to do that, and that's one of the reasons why tanks are first used by the British, and that's on the Somme. Now, most people think of the Somme as only the first day, and the very distinguished historian of World War One, Brian Bond, once mentioned the great problem with British public thought about the Somme was it stopped, or indeed World War One, was that it stopped on the first day of the Somme. And of course, both the Somme develops and other things develop. Incidentally, if I could just add, this might amuse listeners who are aware of the sort of rather funnel nature of many scholars. Some years ago, I was working, you know, just as a lollipop book, an easy book to read whilst, write whilst I was doing something else, on the thought of James Bond. And, you know, it's called The Politics of James Bond, in fact. And I was asked by another major historian, who shall remain nameless, what I was doing. And I mentioned, oh, I'm writing a book on the politics of Bond. And he said to me, oh, he said, you know, Brian's a very nice chap, but I don't think he's that interesting. Anyway, but going back to the Somme, I mean, the Somme obviously goes on. And in fact, what tends to be ignored is that British fighting techniques improve rapidly, far from being the boneheaded generals depicted in that very ignorant work, you know, All Quiet on the West, not All Quiet, Oh, What a Lovely War. Far from being that, I mean, in practical terms, you see enormous developments, not least in artillery application, which are the most important ones, and they put very heavy pressure on the Germans. Wonderful book by Christopher Duffy on the Germans on the Battle of the Somme, showing the enormous pressure their army is under and increasingly under. But anyway, part of this is, of course, the Mark I is used in the attack on the village of Fleurs on the 15th of September 1916. And 11 days later, a tank as well as an aircraft actually capture a trench. And so you get the Daily Sketch by November the 23rd, offering the public their first official pictures of the tank. So, you know, it's used then as a shock weapon. I mean, obviously, as you'll be aware, the standard view is that the British were very foolish, that Haig was very foolish, that they threw away the opportunity of surprise, that they should have waited till they had manufactured far more and used them as they did at Cambrai in 1917 and Amiens in 1918. Well, yeah, that's a point of view, and there's nothing wrong with that point of view. But if it's also worth thinking just a little bit about the alternatives, which is one of the effects of using the tanks in 1916 is to see how they operate in combat circumstances against opposing fire. And that, I think, is a useful exercise. Anyway, so I would say that the use of the tank early, as it were, before they were available in large numbers in September 1916, should not be seen as a disaster. They discovered, for example, at Fleurs, they used 49 of the Mark I's, and only 9 of them reached the German line. So one of the things they discovered is that tanks got stuck in the mud, that you know, the idea that the Caterpillar track would enable them to go over the terrain was very dependent upon the terrain, and that mud was a real problem. And, you know, just as actually, as you'll know, it was an understanding of the implications for tanks or this very different terrains in North Africa in the Western Desert during World War II about sand getting into engine parts. That helps to, again, you know, you have problems. Well, the great thing about having problems is that you seek to overcome them in what, in any weapons technology, is an action and response pattern of development.
And tell me, in those early stages, from the first deployment in the Somme through to the major deployment in November 1917 at the Battle of Cambrai, would you say the major contribution tanks are making are in creating a pathway, cutting barbed wire, forcing the Germans back as they come towards them? Or is it actually as forward artillery pieces?
Well, there are not vast numbers of tanks being used at this stage. I mean, Vimy Ridge, which is April 17, only 8 tanks are deployed. At Passchendaele, tanks are deployed fundamentally in a supporting role. And again, mud gets a problem. I mean, I remember reading the orders for the 169th Infantry Brigade, and it said in the orders, quote, the tank is to be considered purely as an accessory to the attack, and the attack must on no account be allowed to check if the tank should fail to carry out its program. And I read the papers in, I think it was the London Metropolitan Archives, because I did a book on World War One. I don't know if you know this, but I did a book on it. And I remember reading the papers of Arthur Child Villiers, who was an officer, and he comments that he was very uncertain. And, you know, he was not an inflexible man at all, a very thoughtful man, but he comments that he was very uncertain of the value of tanks. So I think it's fair to say that what they're really doing in 1617 is not breaking through, you know, we're talking about prior to Cambrai in November 17, is not using them to, not having an enormous impact with them, but nevertheless developing them and finding out what they are useful for and what they're not useful for. And of course, one of the main things they discover is the significance of what is to be called, or is called already to a certain extent, the goings. In other words, the traversability of the terrain. And as you may know, the British map goings quite considerably, particularly in World War II, and tank traversability of terrain is a key element of them. Well, what they're discovering in late 16, early mid 17 is quite how bad mud is for tanks. And I think that's a real problem because of the nature of the terrain that they're on. I mean, it's less of a problem, interestingly enough, for some of the terrain the French are on further south, where there's more chalk terrain around the Aisne, for example. But north for the British, mud is more of a problem.
And give us, if you will, a sense of what it was like being in one of those early tanks, let's say a Mark IV. How many people are inside? What are they all doing? What are the conditions like?
Awful. I mean, awful. I mean, extraordinarily dangerous for a kickoff. If a tank is I don't know if you've ever fired guns and then looked at what happens to the target. I mean, one of the great problems is something might survive a bullet strike, but it then causes on the inside of the panel, in other words, on the other side of the target, it causes what's called a spool. That's extraordinarily dangerous, and in particular problems affecting the eyes for people. So a lot of tank crew wore chainmail visors. Then on top of that, you've got the heat and the noise, which is very unpleasant. The tanks had poor ventilation, so clean air was also a problem. Every time the tanks went over rough ground, the crew, which they obviously did apart from anything else, if they were going across shell holes, the crew was thrown around. There's obviously no toilet facilities. The whole thing is very unpleasant. Interestingly enough, I mean, tanks are very confined spaces. So you can go down in England. The easiest way to follow this is to go to Bovingdon, the tank museum, which is near Wareham in Dorset. And you can go inside a tank, it's a more modern tank, and, it's not easy. I mean, I'm only just over 6 foot, and I find it very unpleasant. So what somebody bigger than me would find is very difficult. And then on top of that, tanks were highly conspicuous targets. So the Germans, fired artillery pieces at them, as well as machine guns, and, firing direct fire field guns with high explosive shells, they really knock around the tanks of the time. And on top of that, anti-tank mines are there. So it was very frightening. There was not a sense of security. And these people were very brave. If you look at Cambrai, on the 20th of November, 65 of the British tanks are destroyed thanks to direct hits by German artillery fire. Well, you're talking about, as in World War II, going around on top of a, large supply of petroleum. So this is not much fun if the tank gets hit. So, you've got to be aware of that. The British used 348 tanks that day, and the majority of the British losses were due to mechanical faults or tanks stopped by ditches. That's not so directly fatal, but actually getting out of a stuck tank is not much joy if you're exposed to potential German fire at that point. So no, these were risky things to be in. What was, I think, relatively less of a problem than in World War II is that, partly because, as I've already mentioned, there are very few German tanks, there's very little tank-to-tank conflict, if you see what I mean.
Well, I want to turn to the difference between the First and Second World Wars. One of them, and you've just touched on it, is that in the First World War, the Germans didn't develop tanks in large numbers, although they did think about anti-tank measures. By the Second World War, of course, there's the Tiger and then the Panther. What have the Germans learned during that period, and did they develop superior technology, superior strategy? What did they achieve, most obviously, before we get to the Eastern Front, in the invasion of France in May 1940? What did they achieve in their tank development that France and Britain didn't?
Right. Well, there's a whole lot of complex things there, and I've written quite a lot about this. Let's start off. The Tiger and the Panther are not original. The Germans don't start the war with them, and they are not the tanks that are instrumental in the so-called Blitzkrieg operations of 1939 to 1941. The Germans at that point are using tanks that are by no means as strong as tank killers as the ones that you subsequently mention. And indeed, the German tanks in 1940 are quite vulnerable to both tank fire and to anti-tank guns. I mean, you know, everybody's tanks have problems. The French gut tanks are more heavily gunned. They have more effective protection. But also, they're somewhat slower, and many had to turn in order to fire. Incidentally, going back to the point about navies, if you read my book on naval warfare since 1860, I mention repeatedly the problem about the trade-offs between speed, armor, and firepower when you're looking at armored ships as opposed to aircraft carriers. There's no perfect scenario, and the same thing is the case with the tank. The German tanks of 39, 40, 41 have serious limitations, as does everybody else. And that's not really surprising. And as you will know, there's a really extensive literature, and we might almost have a separate program on this, which would be very useful, I think, very interesting to people, on the fall of France in 1940, and how far this is to do with German fighting capability, and how far it's to do with Allied, particularly French, strategic choices, putting their mobile forces on the far left, etc., etc., so they lack defence in depth, and how far also it's to do with, as it were, the second stage, what happens in terms of French resilience after Dunkirk. So these are matters that require a lot of thought and a lot of discussion. I'm afraid, and I don't wish to sound overly harsh, but people that think in terms of explaining these in terms of the sophistication of German tanks and the use of tanks are taking an element and giving it disproportionate weight. And that reflects, alas, what one has so often, which is the saloon bar approach to history. In other words, somebody who will tell you, the BBC does this all the time, that, you know, they have got the hidden explanation or the not hidden explanation, and this is the explanation and it explains it all. Well, it actually doesn't. That is very rarely the case. I would be very wary of arguing that the German tanks were the decisive factor. I think there's a whole host of factors that play. And it's worth bearing in mind that if you're looking at the German tank attack on the Western Front, you have, which is not going to surprise any tank commentator of the period, you have growing numbers of mechanical and other problems. As soon as they start to hit problems in terms of the running down of the tank capacity that they have, as well as obviously facing problems with petrol supplies. And it's therefore one of the whole points about the so-called pause in the Dunkirk period is that the Germans do need then, of course, you get people sometimes saying, making all sorts of blithe statements about how the Germans could readily and easily have moved on to invade Britain. Well, we'll leave aside a whole host of factors to do with British air and sea defences, etc., etc., but it, and also the limited amphibious capabilities the Germans had. But there is also the need to replenish and resupply their army, and in particular their tank force. The Germans were never particularly good. I mean, one of the things that the British were better at in World War II, the Germans were never particularly good at maintenance of their tanks. And that was obviously a problem that was going to be accentuated by the complexity of the tank systems that they subsequently deployed, such as the Tiger.
Well, I want to put an idea out, and that is that an area where the tanks had an enormous effect in the Second World War was in was at a strategic level overestimating or underestimating what they could do. So, for example, the British and French defensive policy in 1940 was based around an assumption that the Ardennes created, if not impenetrable, then a very difficult terrain for tanks to pass through. And similarly, an expectation in Southeast Asia that the jungles and forests of Malaya were not suitable for Japanese armour to pass through, which, of course, proved equally incorrect. Is it fair to say that these misinterpretations of what tanks could and couldn't achieve were actually very, very significant in the development of the Second World War?
Well, that's interesting, very interesting. I would say the biggest mistake was the German assumption in 1941 that the campaign success that they had already enjoyed could be then replicated against the Soviet Union. And as far as the Ardennes is concerned, I think it's fairly clear that it was a close-run thing on the Meuse River crossings, particularly near Sedan. And of course, if the Germans had been defeated there, then everybody would have been saying this was a very foolish German policy. So I'm not sure. I mean, so often, as it were, we argue from results to causes. And I think we've always got to be very careful about that. What you are absolutely correct about is that weapons systems have a rhetorical force as well as, or a perceptual force, as well as what you might call an objective force. And that's something I've always tried to address in my work. It's not always easy to do so. But I think that operates with World War II in a double sense. One, it operates in terms of how weapon systems were seen subsequently. So, for example, there is the argument to be had that subsequently the effectiveness during World War II, this is going to shock a lot of people, of aircraft carriers as opposed to battleships was exaggerated, and that battleships were still a very useful weapons system, particularly in terms of bombarding, defending coastlines, but also, of course, if you wanted to operate in the dark and things like that. And that the aircraft carrier doesn't really come into its own until the 1950s, when all-weather flying is more effective. Now, that's one level, and we could discuss that, and I have discussed that. But if you're looking at tanks, I always used to say to my students that the most underrated, because I did a special subject for many years on World War II, that the most underrated weapon of World War II was the anti-tank gun. And I would argue that that is obviously true in hindsight. I mean, look at the respective way in which tanks and anti-tank guns are treated in war films made since 1945. But also, I think it's true in perception terms during the war. And here what's interesting is you get commanders who are well aware that the, as it were, the almost the love affairs going too wrong, far wrong, but you know, the kind of fashion for the tank needs to be put in its place of the tank as a form of mobile artillery, which is most effective when it's used alongside supporting artillery and infantry. And that, of course, doesn't make for very convincing war films at the time or subsequently. But also, it's a harder sell if you're looking to try and persuade civilian politicians or military politicians who are, you know, senior military figures are politicians in uniform, who want the war over by Christmas or want the second front this year or whatever they want, whatever they feel it is necessary to advocate. And sometimes you need people who are total bastards to say, no, we're not doing it that way. This is the way to be effective, and this is what we're going to do. And I certainly think that if you're looking at World War II combined arms operations at the tactical and operational level were absolutely crucial. And that is something that, in a sense, one sort of passes by if one puts the emphasis on German tanks going through the Ardennes. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that the German forces that crossed the Middle Meuse, having crossed through the Ardennes, were combined armed forces, and that that was instrumental. If they just simply turned up with tanks, it wouldn't have done much good. And the same with the Japanese. The Japanese who moved through Malaya were combined armed forces. And in many senses, what World War II is often at the tactical and operational level is clashes between combined armed forces, which are then disaggregated due to later fascination with particular weapon systems.
Which brings me on to the question of two battles which are always described rather loosely as tank battles. The decisive battle of El Alamein and also Kursk on the Eastern Front. Is this description actually very unhelpful? And we should see tanks, although there were a great number of them in both of those battles, they were part of an integrated whole, or are they so described because the tanks were the most salient feature?
Well, Kursk, as you mentioned, is a bigger battle in terms of scale than El Alamein. Kursk is one in which the Soviet defenders are successful. As you will know, there's been an extensive recent literature querying the respective tank losses of the two sides, etc., etc. But the key thing was that the Germans lost. You can debate the casualty levels, but the Germans lost, and the German plan was not fulfilled. I mean, they used the Tiger and the Panther, as well as the Ferdinand self-propelled guns at Kursk. But the Soviets had produced really effective systems of defense in depth. They knew where the Germans were coming. Well, it wasn't too difficult to work out. You know, despite the German losses being less than they're often claimed, and despite there being some poor Soviet command decisions, the Germans were outfought. I think there's, and you know, you could argue if you want that the en masse use by Soviet T-34s is more effective than the German Panther and Tigers, but I would say that you have to understand the T-34s as part of a more general pattern in which the Soviets are using a lot of artillery, a lot of anti-tank ditches, a lot of mines, all of which are significant. So I don't think one should just see it as a tank battle. El Alamein, exactly the same. The British were up against extensive minefields. They were up against well-located anti-tank guns. It wasn't an easy battle for the British, but the British did manage, and when I say the British, ones including, you know, sort of Dominion forces who play a very major role, that they do sort of fight down both their opponents. And Montgomery, I think it's worth saying, he read the terrain ably. He shows a lot of adaptability at changing his plan. He has an ability to sequentially attack and force Rommel to commit his forces, which reminds me, actually, of the Duke of Marlborough's methods at Blenheim in 1704. You know, you might change the technology, but there are similar forms of battle planning. Now, you know, obviously the initial progress was slow, and the British proved ineffective in many respects at executing the pursuit, so that the more of the Germans got away. Same thing, incidentally, that happens after Falaise in 44. They had fought their way through a formidable defended system, and in what, in practical terms, is an effective combined arms operation. And the British, I mean, the key, as far as fighting on the ground is concerned, the key British arm in World War II is the artillery. The British 25-pounder is an extraordinarily effective gun. It is used very well. A lot of British commanders are people that had come through the artillery, and World War I is an artillery war. So these are very impressive. And the second most effective thing is many of the, not all the infantry regiments, but many of the infantry regiments are really excellent. It has to be said that you have brave people in the armour and some talented commanders in the armour, but too often Montgomery and other senior generals have to fight against the tendency of many armor officers to wish to charge off and on their own. And this reflects, to a degree, I think, the cavalry background of many of the officers. And that obviously puts them in an exposed position vis-a-vis German anti-tank guns. But, you know, the El Alamein, and indeed John Buckley's book, I think, is excellent on 21st Army Group in Northwest Europe in 44-45, you see really high-quality British fighting capability. And I'm afraid to say that the argument by Mr. Hastings about the Germans, I find very unconvincing. I mean, ultimately, the Germans were defeated, and their fighting quality, and not just defeated by the British, defeated by French forces, defeated when they're up unit for unit against the Americans, defeated when they're up unit to unit against the Soviets. I mean, the German army has been seriously overestimated as a result of reading from its performance in 39-40 into a broader account of the war.
And as the Allied forces close in on Germany from both the west and the east, what do the tanks need to fear most? Obviously, the Luftwaffe is being pulled back. So is it a case that you know, with air superiority, the tanks don't have so much to fear from the air? Or is it anti-tank traps? Is it mines? Is it, you know, bazookas? How effective was the German anti-tank defence as the Allies closed in?
Well, the Germans had, of course, in the 88mm, a good, originally designed as an anti-aircraft gun, but a good anti-tank gun. And as you will know, the Germans put some of their anti-tank guns into tank destroyers, in other words, mobile sort of anti-tank guns. And I do discuss in the book the difficulty in assessing what a tank is when you're looking, for example, at mobile anti-tank guns, tank destroyers. And, you know, there's a whole host of things that are used against tanks. And, you know, having a flamethrower at you is not exactly very jolly. But the practicality is that the Allied tank forces, as part of combined army units, go an enormous long way. I mean, they land, the Western Allies land in Normandy on the 6th of June 1944. Within a year, they're on the Elbe. The Soviets defeat the Germans outside Stalingrad at the end of 42. By the summer of 44, they're on the Vistula. By the spring of 45, they're on the Elbe. So these are formidable achievements against a major power. And I think it's fair to say that there were heavy casualties, and those casualties are ones that we should honour. But equally, it's fair to say that Allied fighting effectiveness was high and it was successful. And of course, it was then replicated in terms of army operations in the later stages of the war by the success of British and Empire forces against the Japanese in Burma and the success of Soviet forces against the Japanese in Manchuria. There, much greater use of tanks. And the Americans used tracked vehicles, some of them tanks, some of them, you know, other sort of mobile engineering units, sort of fortified armored engineering units, flamethrowers and other such things, on their operations against the Japanese in places like Okinawa and Iwo Jima. So tanks or armor had a role all the way through and was particularly successful in terms of combined operations.
If we move forward into the Cold War period, the untrained eye looking at the sort of armoured vehicles, the tanks in particular, lining up on either side of the Fulda Gap, let's say in the early 1980s, to the untrained eye, they look bigger than the, you know, the Tigers, the Panthers, the T-34s of the Second World War, but fundamentally, from the outside, they don't look so different. What, therefore, were, you know, in these decades of innovation that's taken place between 1945 and, let's say, the early 1980s, what, for the trained eye, is actually the difference? Is it the power of the artillery piece? Is it the manoeuvrability and speed? Where was the focus?
Well, there's all sorts of things. And again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, it depends what specification you want. Do you want armour? And armour slows you down, as well as also causing a damn nuisance if you're trying to cross bridges which aren't strong enough to bear your weight. Do you want speed? And if you want speed, what are you willing to put up with in terms of lower armor for that? What kind of gun do you want? And obviously, that has all sorts of implications. So if you take, for example, the 1950, a tank that comes through then, which is the M46 Patton, it has a 90mm gun, which is good firepower. It has a new air-cooled gasoline engine and a hydraulic transmission system. But it's probably too big, therefore it's an easy target for other you know, people firing at it. So you've got all sorts of problems. Other specifications you might want are range. In other words, how much petrol, how much gas do you want to put in the tank? And what range does this mean? Do you want what's known as secondary armament? Secondary armament are machine guns. So one of the classic things in the Korean War is the American tanks would often, what they called, I mean, don't want to upset people listening, but war is not jolly. They would hose each other down. Hosing each other down is that if you have opposing Chinese infantry scrabbling on top of you, a tank will fire its machine guns at another tank in order to kill the infantry on it. So, you know, there is not, one of the things I'd be absolutely crucially trying to underline is there is not a unique, and this goes right up to the present day, a unique set of criteria. You get improvement, but improvement can come with cost and also with the difficulties of manufacture. So classic improvements that that comes up during the Cold War, infrared viewing devices for nighttime. You see, that's important because it means you get a high first shot kill capability at night, which had certainly not been the case earlier on. Well, that doesn't weigh very much, so that's okay. But if you, for example, are looking at some of the more modern tanks, if you look at the, for example, the Israeli tank, which is, you know, a good, effective tank, but it is very heavy, and that therefore has all sorts of implications of its usability. And I think it's fair to say that modern tanks are, you know, which have very very complex armor, the idea being that you should detonate the round which is going to hit you and that you should be able to identify it by a sensor. All of that comes with high cost, and all of that has implications in terms of the bulk of what you're getting. And you can get some of that stuff with mechanized combat vehicles. So if you take the British Warrior, which comes out in 1988, it's not called a tank, but it has a 30mm cannon, it has a chain machine gun. It's not a bad vehicle for its type, although of course that again depends upon what it's going to be up against, and in particular, you know, the strength and nature of roadside bombs in places like Afghanistan. And you've got the weight of the tanks, I would say, is something that's really helped, though, to create problems for the present day. You have bigger and bigger and heavier tanks at the present day, which is designed to ensure that they are not so vulnerable to improvised explosive devices, or indeed to other tanks or to anti-tank guns. But that comes with an enormous cost. And it's very interesting that often main battle tanks, the very heavy tanks, have proved less attractive to international purchasers than lighter and more mobile tanks like the German Leopard, which, in fact, if you're interested, you can see they often put a Leopard through its paces at Bovingdon. And, you know, it's a more mobile tank, and it's because it's lighter. I would be misleading you or listeners if I was to say there is a perfect tank. And again, taking that a stage further, something we haven't mentioned, which is what willingness do you have for your tank crew to get killed? It may well be that if you're a Russian or a Chinese general, you are more prepared to have tanks lost, blown up, and people, let's be clear about this, burned alive, that in order to keep going and to have lots of tanks that are relatively cheap. Or you might take the view that no, you want the protection of your tank crew or your tankers to be more significant, and you're willing to take different specifications in terms of maneuverability and cost to that end. And it's not that one's right and the other's wrong.
Well, one thing that clearly has happened over the last 100 years of tank development is speed and mobility. I think that the Mark 1 back in 1916 could manage about 3 miles per hour, whereas the Russians T-14, one of their newest tanks, it claims to be able to do about 55 miles per hour on a good day. Are we now moving, therefore, to a period where a lighter, faster tanks of the future, maybe the age of the MBT, the main battle tank, is over? We are wanting to deploy in distant parts of the world. That means an ability to carry lighter tanks, longer distances. And then there is the prospect of urban warfare, where again we might be looking at more light armoured vehicles than tanks. Are we beginning to see the end of the heavy tank? And is this implicit, if not yet explicit, in the British latest defence spending round, the new four-year defence spending that has just been announced?
Well, I mean, that's really good, and we really ought to try and have another programme on this, on the modern thing. But let's just give several points. It's not just the British. I mean, as you probably know, the American Marines, and the American Marines are in practice the alternative army for the Americans. The American Marines have decided to scrap their main battle tanks, as well as the bridging units that were required for tanks, because they argued, General Berger, the commandant, told the Congressional Committee, we're designed for a competition behind us, not in front of us. And that, I think, was a valid point to make. And the fact that your opponent has tanks, I mean, as you correctly mentioned, the Russians have tanks, the Chinese have tanks, does not mean that you necessarily should be aiming to meet them with tanks. It means you need to match them with what is going to be effective weaponry. Now, the Chinese H-712 anti-tank missiles, for example, they are pretty good. What was very interesting in the very recent conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia is Israeli and Turkish drone technology was destroying the Russian tanks deployed by the Armenians. And obviously, tanks, if useful, require mass. In other words, you've got to be willing to take tanks breaking down, tanks being destroyed, and most states are simply not going to be able to have that kind of mass. So one really does have to ask, what is particularly useful. I mean, it's quite interesting to see, there's been a lot of discussion about how Taiwan might respond to a Chinese attack. And as you may know, the Taiwanese publicly announced in 2019 that they wanted 108 of the American Abrams tanks, but they also asked for 1,649 anti-tank missiles. The missile component is very much that of an element of asymmetrical warfare if they're up against Chinese tank attacks. I think it is really difficult here. You've got the contrast between so-called symmetrical and so-called asymmetrical warfare, and you've got what I've argued is a continuum between the two. A tank is useful. Soldiers wish to feel protected, and a tank can give you a measure of protection. But at the same time, it has its own vulnerabilities and its own limitations, including limitations in terms of defensibility, but also in terms of flexibility. And given that there is only so much money in the kitty, I think from the British Army's perspective, highly trained soldiers capable of operating in a multifaceted fashion is probably more useful than another generation of main battle tanks.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, we will return in a future podcast to the priorities of modern day warfare. But for now, your new book, Tank Warfare, is just published. We must leave it. But as ever, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you. And for listeners who are interested, I'd like to think it is a good book. There's one other very good book by another scholar, Alaric Searle's book, S-E-A-R-L-E. And I think, they nicely complement each other. So I'd like to mention his book as well. And I'd also like, you asked about both World War One and World War Two. I have written specific books on each of those wars, and I would urge people to look at those. And also, the tank book itself falls in as part of a sequence of books. There's a book on air warfare, there's a book on insurgency and counterinsurgency warfare, there's a book on fortification, there's a book on land warfare, and there's a book on naval warfare. And all of these are designed to be read independently, and I'm delighted to say I think they can be discussed independently, but they also are designed to support each other. So if it's not too much to ask of the patience of listeners, I do think if you are really interested in military affairs today, in the past, in the future, you really need to actually spend a long time reading some of those.
Well, thank you for that guidance, Professor Jeremy Black. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.